Horace was taken up several flights of stairs to a wide terrace at the top of the world. The patio was bedecked with so many plants, from flowers and shrubs to waving trees 30 feet tall, that it looked like a forest. Through the verdant decor, he spotted a marble balustrade along the edge overlooking a breathtaking view of the city below. As the guards took up positions by the door, Horace looked around. The place was a paradise in the sky. The queen arrived through another door. She was accompanied by a half dozen bodyguards and one of the wizard twins, the one called Gilgun. The sorcerer glared at Horace from three steps behind the queen, and a little tickle traveled up the back of his neck. Horace was ready to pass it off as a product of his anxiety, but then he realized he'd felt it before, the exact same tickle on his neck when he was practicing with Lord Mulcibar. In fact, he'd felt it several times since his arrival in Akeshia.
It must be tied to the Zawana. Their presence, or the Queen's, triggers it.
Horace made a formal bow. The Queen returned a slight curtsy. This evening, she wore a diaphanous gown of white silk, belted high on the waist.
I'm so glad you accepted my invitation, Master Horace. I felt like taking an evening ride.
Ride, Your Excellence?
A large oblong shape emerged from the shadow of the palace. It was long, with curved sides, its wooden bottom extending to sharp wedges fore and aft. With majestic grace, it sailed down toward them. The flying ship, and that's the only way he could describe it, floated down beside the terrace. Its upper deck had no masts or rigging, and nothing that resembled a wheelhouse. The gunwales were decorated with intertwining vines painted in gold leaf. This design continued to the forward section, where it expanded into a bas-relief display showing a row of ships sailing on a sea of clouds, all also done in gold. A purple canopy shaded the center deck. Three men stood on the deck, one at the bow and two at the stern. As the ship got closer, Horace saw that each man clasped waist-high metal poles that rose from the planking. Byleth followed Horace to the balustrade.
What do you think of my barge?
I would have never believed it if I wasn't seeing it for myself. A flying ship. A real flying ship, like in the legends. How does it work?
I'll explain during the trip.
We're actually going aboard?
Of course. I want to show you something.
Good afternoon, Your Majesty, Master Horace.
Lord Mulcibar emerged onto the terrace, hobbling on his cane. He had changed since meeting with Horace into a soft cornflower robe with a black cape.
Good afternoon, my lord.
The queen drew nearer to Horace and shifted her hand to wrap around his upper arm.
Shall we?
Lord Mulcibar nodded and waved them ahead. Horace, eager to see the flying ship up close, moved to the narrow gangplank that had been lowered. Byleth went across without pause, but Horace could not help looking down. He felt better when he stepped aboard the flying vessel and felt the buoyant spring of the deck. The wind blowing through his hair was dry and fragrant, but it was close enough to a sea breeze that he didn't mind. The deck was long but not very wide, and it felt crowded as the last bodyguard climbed aboard. The gangplank was pulled up, and the ship set off. It turned like a gigantic bird, with slow and gentle grace as it took a northwesterly course. The deck swayed gently from side to side, almost like the roll of a seagoing vessel.
Where are we going?
We are taking a little tour. Come, stand with me over here.
The others gave Horace and Byleth some room as she pulled him to the port side of the flying ship. He steeled himself to look over the polished railing that encircled the deck. The ship had risen even farther off the ground. The palace was already far behind and below them as they sailed over the city. The buildings and streets dwindled beneath them, people shrinking to the size of fleas until he couldn't distinguish them anymore. After a few minutes, his nervousness melted away. It felt good to be aboard a ship again, even one soaring hundreds of fathoms above the ground. The queen pointed at a sprawling building with several wings and a large expanse of gardens inside a stone enclosure.
Do you see there? That is where I grew up. Except when my father sent me to the springs at Hikak. Every winter.
Winter? Does it get cold here then?
Oh yes. Sometimes we have to wear jackets or shawls outside and burn coals in our rooms at night. Of course, there are more interesting ways to stay warm.
Horace studied the city beneath them. They were passing over blackened areas that looked like they had engulfed entire neighborhoods. The destruction was complete, leaving not a single outbuilding untouched.
Are those the granaries?
No. Those were the barracks of my city guard. They were burned down on the night of the storm.
Your Excellence, I just want you to know that I had nothing to do with the attack.
Of course not, Horace. I never suspected you for a moment. It was done by my enemies, who want to see me dead.
People are trying to kill you?
Though I try to rule lightly, there are some who would stop at nothing to pull me down. Your countrymen, for instance. They used the cover of the storm to kill my guards and burn the granaries that feed my people. If they are not stopped, someday they may succeed in ending my life.
I'm sorry. I hope they won't succeed.
I believe that. Do you recall that you asked me about Tamuris?
Yes. That envoy, Lord Bafetor, mentioned it. You never told me why.
Tamuris comes in 5 days on the new moon. That evening, I must wed my betrothed, Prince Tatanu. Lord Bafetor was so kind to remind me that my fate has been sealed.
I don't understand.
That is the pact I signed with the other cities when my father was killed. In exchange for my life, I promised to wed the son of my father's arch-enemy. That day approaches. And when it comes, the Sun Temple will rule Erugash in name as well as deed. And I will cease to be valuable. Do you know what happens to a queen once she no longer has any value?
In Arnos, the queen is the mother of our people. She always has value.
In Akeshia, a woman has only what value her husband says she has, whether she is a queen or a shepherdess.
So, are you going to tell me how this ship works?
The three men holding onto the metal poles are, of course, Zoanii, and they power the ship's engine, which is below decks, with their magic. The ship is steered by helmsmen at the fore instead of the aft, like on a nautical vessel. The men at the stern control the amount of power that flows to the engine.
What if something happened to one of the men powering the ship? Would it fall?
Not at once. With two Zoanii powering the engine, we could still fly, though at a far slower pace.
And with only one?
I'm not sure. Shall I command them to let go and see what happens?
No, thank you, Excellence. Can I see the engine?
I don't know. It's quite cramped below, and I might not be able to restrain myself with you in such close quarters.
Why don't we find out?
Are you more interested in me, or how the engine works?
Well, both, actually.
Unfortunately, only those trained by the Imperial School in Seasa are allowed to view the inner workings. I'm sure you understand.
Horace turned his attention to the land below. The sun was just a sliver of gold above the horizon. They had passed far beyond the city limits. The land hugging the river was divided into square sections of honey-brown fields. But everything beyond the riparian zone was a wasteland of cracked earth and dust. Ahead, to the northwest, the wastes gave way to a vast golden sea. Even from a distance, and it had to be a score of leagues or more, the desert was impressive, beautiful and mysterious, like the women of this strange land, and just as dangerous. The sun was setting before them, framing the world in a brilliant orange patina. Horace studied the sky. It was crystal blue, without a hint of clouds.
Tell me more about your homeland.
I miss the smells.
The perfumes of your pale northern ladies?
No. The smells of leather and horse. The stink of the city streets, the middens and the fish smells of the docks. The smell of pitch and pine wood.
It sounds filthy.
It is, but it's home.
Our teachers say that the Western countries are always making war. What do you say to that?
I guess I'd say they're right. We've had several wars just during my lifetime. And the great war between the Nemean Empire and its outer states was only a century and a half ago. But we have peaceful times as well. Our trade depends upon it.
But you served on a ship of war.
The Bantu Rey was merchantmen, originally. But when the Crusade got underway, we were commandeered for the war effort. Our captain didn't have much choice in the matter.
So, you are not a zealot, gripped by the Führer of your one god? No? I think you are more like a piece of wood floating on the river, pushed wherever the water goes.
Flotsam.
What?
Nothing. You may be right. I signed on with the Ray because I wanted to belong to something real, something bigger than my life. I suppose that must be hard for a queen to understand.
No, it's not.
Byleth traced the palm of Horus's left hand over the mottled whorls and dimples of the ruined flesh.
How did you get these scars? They are not immaculata.
What do you want with me?
I need to know more about your people. How far will they press their crusade against Akeshia? What would convince them to give up the fight?
From what I saw, Your Excellence, nothing will deter them. The Church will not rest until your country has been defeated and converted to the true faith, whether that takes a year or a century.
They had entered the desert. The sands flowed beneath them like a golden blanket. Horus watched the dunes pass by when he spotted a dark smudge on the horizon. He shaded his eyes against the dwindling daylight and made out some kind of settlement encircled by a long, low wall. At least it looked low from this distance. Square buildings and lean towers nestled inside the fortifications. The flying ship slowed its velocity and turned due west on a course that would take it close to the town. As they got closer, Horus could see a second dark smudge outside the wall. He squinted and leaned over the rail. It was too far away to count, but he guessed there had to be hundreds of tents staked out on the sands. Earthworks and defensive fortifications surrounded the walls. The town was under siege.
Who's fighting?
That is Omikur, one of my most vital holdings in the desert. It has never fallen to an invading force until 2 days ago when it was seized by an army from Etonia. We suspect the invaders might have had an agent inside the town. However it was done, the capture was a bold move, especially since they are many leagues from the sea and the protection of your fleets.
And the camp is your army?
My third legion, under the command of Lord General Arishaka.
There must be 5,000 men in that camp, with another 3,000 or 4,000 strung out along the siege works. I'm afraid I won't be much use as a soldier, Your Excellence.
Master Horus, really? You think I would ask you to fight your own people? No. We are here merely to observe.
A little relieved, but still not sure how much to believe her, Horus focused his attention on the siege. With the daylight waning, he didn't expect much activity. Yet men scurried along the earthworks, and the town walls were filled with soldiers. Horus hadn't noticed the ship descending. They were now only a couple of bowshots above the dunes and sailing along at a slower pace. As he looked over the side, a forest of great wooden arms sprang up from the earthworks, sending dozens of fireballs sailing through the sundered twilight. The orbs of burning death burst, some upon the battlements where they spread viscous flames among the troops, and others inside the town, exploding in the streets. Yet the town was well designed against attack. The walls were protected by machicolations and hoardings with sloped roofs that repelled the burning missiles. Still, a few penetrated the defenses. Soldiers thrashed as they burned. The fortunate ones were put to the sword by their comrades, but too often those comrades also caught fire when they came too close to their burning fellows, and so the carnage spread.
My god.
Not your god, nor any of mine. This is science and sorcery. The worst of both. Do you see what monsters war makes of us all?
Horus tried to watch the scene below with detachment, but it wasn't easy. Now, seeing the town's walls up close, they were sturdier than he first thought. And although the fire pots were deadly, the defenders were quick to douse them with sand, which worked much better than water. Gazing at the great catapults amid the earthworks, cocking back for another volley, Horus was tempted to try his powers, to sever the pulley ropes that worked the siege weapons, or to ignite the fire pots in midair. He made no move to help the defenders, however. With the queen standing so close to him, she would sense if he tried anything. His stomach dropped when a crackle of thunder raced across the sky above. the vessel swung around on a northerly course, circling the town. Yet Horus was watching the sky. Byleth gestured, and the helmsman consulted a spherical device mounted beside his station. Then clouds appeared from nowhere, and the sky darkened. A bolt of lurid green lightning shot from the sky. The clouds swirled with twisting winds, gathering into a maelstrom above the city. Horus's gaze was drawn to the center of the storm. There, behind the screen of thunderheads, he sensed a presence. The hunger. An insatiable need to destroy and consume. It washed over him and entered him. He was powerless to resist its call, unable to stop the connection between him and the longing. And in that moment, he sensed he was close to understanding something vital about the storm, or maybe himself. The ship shuddered as a tongue of lightning slashed the sky off the starboard bow.
What say you, Stormlord? Shall we dance with the gods?
Horus could only watch in horror as the chaos storm swept over the town. A fire had exploded within the urban center where the buildings were clustered closest together. Emerald brilliance stung his eyes again as another bolt lanced from the sky and a tall tower collapsed. More fires leapt up inside the crumbling structure. The urge to help almost overcame Horus until cool fingers touched his hand. The Queen leaned against him as the flying ship swung away from the town. Squeezing his elbow, she smiled at him before she sauntered away. Omicur drifted in their wake, now just a spot of yellow light in the darkness of the desert. The storm remained above the settlement, blasting the walls with occasional lightning. Lord Mulcibar came to stand beside him. Glass orbs had come alive at both ends of the flying ship, glowing like giant fireflies.
She's testing you.
I wish she would find someone else to torment.
Be wary of what you wish for, Master Horus.
You mean it can get worse than this? I'm a prisoner to the people my country is at war with, and I have to just watch as those crusaders down there are slaughtered. If this is a test, then I'm glad to fail it.
You have to understand the delicacy of the situation. We are an old civilization. We watched your nations grow from tribes of fur-wearing savages, and some of us still have a hard time believing that your people have advanced all that much. Then there is our politics. All power in Akeshia flows from the Zoanii. Yet the Temple of the Sun has clawed its way into dominance over all the other cults, largely due to the Emperor's favor, and now it chafes under our rule. Akeshia has suffered through more civil wars than I can easily recall. And now we teeter on the edge of another, one which might change the face of the Empire. Keeping you close is in Her Majesty's best interest, and yours.
Oh? How's that?
You have the Zoana, but you are not of the Zoanii. You have no family here, no master, no liege.
And no loyalties, right?
Exactly. You are a weapon with no attachments. That makes you unique in Akeshia, and it makes you valuable.
So the Queen has to keep an eye on me to make sure no other faction scoops me up. I understand that much. But what's in it for me?
You can consider the alternative. We live in a time of violent upheaval. Without Her Majesty's aegis, you would be without allies.
Not even you, Lord Mulcibar.
I am an old man. You might be powerful, perhaps the strongest magician we've seen in generations. But you can't defeat the entire Empire by yourself.
What are you two whispering about?
Lord Mulcibar bowed and retreated as Queen Byleth returned.
Nothing much. History, actually.
Ugh. My tutors bored me with history for years. None of it makes any difference. The past is gone. It's the future that concerns me.
I don't know how you do it. You're the ruler of a city, but you're so young and...
What? A woman?
Well, I just meant that...
Don't worry. I've been called much worse than that. Ask Lord Mulcibar to take you on a tour of the river district in Erugash. There's some very inventive graffiti about me.
I'm sorry, Your Excellence. It was ungrateful of me to refer to your sex.
Master Horus, you are anything but ungrateful.
The deck of the flying ship bucked as if the vessel had struck a reef. Byleth collapsed in Horus's arms in a faint. He tried to hold her upright, but the ship lurched again and rolled halfway over onto its starboard side. As the ship dropped out of the sky like a stone, Byleth slumped to the floor. The wizard at the bow helm collapsed in a tangle of scorched flesh and smoldering robes. His body slid over the edge as the flying ship tipped forward. Several soldiers fell off too, flailing in the air. Horace put his back to the railing and gathered the queen into his arms. The flying ship continued to pitch. Lord Mulcibar lay flat against the deck next to him, somehow staying fixed in position. To Horace's right, only one wizard helmsman remained in the aft section, hanging from the metal pole. Gilgum held on to the railing with one arm. Horace craned his neck to look down and regretted it at once. The ground was coming up fast to meet him. The queen stirred in Horace's arms. He looked down to see her eyes opening. She appeared confused, or perhaps just dazed. Then he felt the power thrumming in his chest. He reached for it and gasped as the white-hot energy surged through every fiber of his body. Horace hoisted the queen higher into his arms. With only a handful of seconds to act, he embraced the first idea to cross his mind. His eyes sought out the helm pole at the bow of the ship, a dozen yards above him across the canted deck. If his powers could drive away a chaos storm, he reasoned that they should be able to manipulate something more solid. At least, he hoped so. With a tentative touch, he tried to reach out with the Zoana. Nothing happened. The ship continued to plummet to the ground. Horace reached for the metal pole again. This time, he felt a chilling tingle like cool steel running across his brain. He didn't pause to appreciate the oddness of it all. He envisioned himself wrenching back on the handle. The deck rolled beneath his feet, slowly righting itself. He glanced over to the side. Too late. The ground still raced toward them. He saw the river, so close he could make out the ripples of its current and the tops of several boulders sticking out of the water. Horace's energy pulsed within him. He tried pulling up on the helm pole, but the ship's trajectory remained fixed. Then firm hands slapped against either side of his head and forced him to look down. The queen's eyes were wide open.
Push against the ground!
Horace reached out ahead of the falling ship, not expecting to find anything, but he did. A horizontal force beneath them, firm against his mental touch. With the queen's eyes locked on him, he pushed against it with everything he had. The river wound like a sunbathing serpent, lush and brown amid the riparian grasses that grew along its flanks. Gazing at it from the shadow of a huge boulder on the riverbank, Horace could appreciate it more than he had from the air. In the desert, the river was life, yet it had come close to being the site of their death. Dawn had come, bringing with it the heat of the day. A line of sweat dribbled down his forehead as he thought back to those panicked final moments on board the flying ship. At the Queen's command, he had pushed against the ground, or, to be more precise, against the powerful force he'd felt running along the ground. He could still feel it under his feet, firm and unyielding, but also comfortable in a familiar way. At the time, he'd thought it would be impossible to stop a falling ship with just his mind, but the Zoana had responded. The ship had bucked under him like an unbroken stallion, shaking so violently he almost lost his grip on the queen, but somehow he held on. Then the ship struck the ground hard enough to crack the hull in half and throw them over the side. He fell in the shallows of the river and got up without a scratch. His clothing, now caked in mud, took the worst of the damage. Horace glanced back at their makeshift camp beside the river. The queen sat on a small rock, her arms wrapped about her knees, face resting on her forearms. Though she hadn't been injured, as far as he could tell, she hadn't talked much since their landing, either. Lord Mulcibar sprawled on the ground beside the queen, a rolled cloak under his head. Horace had found him in the weeds, eyes open and staring up at the sky, but alive. With a little cajoling, Mulcibar had come around and managed to walk on his own, allowing Horace to focus his attention on the queen. One soldier had survived as well, although he'd suffered a broken leg. Horace had done his best to make the man comfortable under the tree. That was it. No sign of Gilgan or the helmsman. Just four survivors out of a score. But it was a miracle any of them still lived.
What caused the ship to crash? I remember a loud sound like an explosion. No, there were two explosions. The initial one that started the descent and then another on the way down.
The ship now lay in pieces along the water's edge. Horace considered going over to take a look, but instead he went to check on the queen. She was looking a little better. Some of the color had returned to her face.
We'll decide when we get back to Erugash.
Your Majesty, it is not yet clear what caused this incident.
We should consider all possibilities.
Byleth stood up, swaying a little as she regained her feet. Horus offered a hand, and she took it, leading him away. She steered him down to the river where they walked along the muddy banks.
What do we do now?
I summoned aid from the city. As we speak, another vessel is on its way.
How does that work? Can you call to anywhere?
No, only to a location that has been specifically prepared to receive my call. There is such a spot in the palace, which is manned by my servants every hour of the day and night. It is a useful skill, one you should learn.
So now we wait?
Now we wait.
Excellence, there is something I want to ask you.
Anything. You saved my life and the lives of my servants. Ask anything of me and it shall be yours.
Would you allow me to leave and go home?
Yes, if that is your wish.
Thank you.
Within 2 turns of the moon's cycle. If I allowed you to leave now, there would be repercussions. Give me some time to put my troubles to rest, and then I shall send you home. I swear this by the spirits of my ancestors. May they strike me dead if I do not.
I would like something else as well, Excellence. My slave, Excellence. I would like her freed from bondage, permanently.
As you wish. But I would urge caution. You would not be the first man of stature, nor the first woman for that matter, to seek affection in the arms of a slave. All too often, once freed of their bonds, the object of desire is not so agreeable as before.
No, that's not it. I'm just not comfortable being served by a slave. Call it a cultural difference.
Are all Westerners so gallant toward their servants?
You're teasing me, Excellence.
Just a little. I try to deal fairly with my people, Master Horus, though it's not always easy. There are not many I can trust outside my circle.
A stinging itch buzzed down the back of Horus's neck. He reached for his power without realizing it, and was mildly surprised at how quickly it came to him, rushing through his chest and out to his extremities. Byleth shoved Horus, and they both tumbled to the ground as something blisteringly hot passed over them. The tops of several reed stalks evaporated in puffs of black smoke, delineating a horizontal line as if they'd been sliced off with a saber. Horus started to sit up.
What in the hell?
Byleth pressed a hand to his mouth, silencing him. Horus listened, but he didn't hear anything. Byleth removed her hand, but did not speak. She froze as a person emerged from the tall grass beside them. His hair disheveled, he pointed something at the queen that looked like a baton, thin and black. It took Horus a moment to recognize the man as one of the aft helmsmen of the flying ship. The queen pushed out from her chest with both hands. A surge of wind picked up the helmsman, flipped him upside down, and flung him to the ground. This was the Dominion of Wind Lord Mulsivar had mentioned. Imavar, he called it. The helmsman struggled against the currents of air, pinning him down, but he couldn't break their hold. His jaws were stretched open like he was trying to shout, but no sounds emerged. Byleth stared at her servant with a fierce concentration. After several seconds, the helmsman shuddered and then lay still. Another figure emerged from the reeds. Horus moved in front of the queen and steeled himself for another violent encounter until he saw it was Lord Mulsivar. Byleth stepped out from behind Horus. Mulsivar knelt beside the dead helmsman. The nobleman found the baton and snapped it in half.
How long do we have?
Not long.
Why would... You're hurt.
He noticed blood dripping from the queen's left hand. She opened her fingers to reveal blood welling from a deep gash in her palm. Horus stripped off his tunic and wrapped it around her hand. As soon as he had tied it tight, she grabbed him by the arm and pulled him along, away from the campsite. Mulsivar limped behind them.
We have to move quickly. They'll be here soon.
They who? Hold on. Do you mean the crash was an assassination attempt?
Her Majesty's entourage has been compromised, as I feared.
We don't know all the facts.
I would know more if I could perform a death reading on the bodies from the crash.
It cannot be helped.
The reeds were thinning, revealing more of the desert beyond the river. They were heading east with the setting sun at their backs.
My soldier?
Dead.
The queen nodded as if the news didn't bother her, but Horus caught a brief tightening of the skin around her eyes. Horus was about to ask where they were running to when a tingle ran up his neck, accompanied by a cold sweat across his brow. He whipped his head back and forth, trying to determine where it was coming from. Then he noticed that he was still holding on to his power. He hadn't let go after Mulcibar appeared. The feeling of the magic flowing through his body was a comfort. Realizing that the next attack was upon them, Horus stopped, yanking his arm from the Queen's grasp. Something urged him to get low, so he dropped to one knee and was a little surprised to see Byleth crouch down in front of him. Mulcibar did the same. Horus blinked against a sudden bright light that flashed before his eyes. The itch down his neck increased. More dazzling lights filled the air around them. Byleth and Mulcibar gestured in different directions. Everywhere they pointed, tiny explosions rocked the riverbank, followed by thin columns of black smoke. Horus had no idea what they were doing or how to help, so he kept low and waited. After a handful of heartbeats, the dazzling display ended as Byleth and Mulcibar stopped whatever they had been doing, and all three of them listened. Horus started to hope that the danger was past, but then a horrible sensation welled up behind him. He turned and spotted something rising from the riverbank. It looked like a humpbacked creature covered in mud, but then it stood up straight. It was a man-shaped thing, more than 10 feet tall, with a wizened, wrinkled face. Brown water dripped from its body and limbs. Mulcibar gestured at the creature. A thin trickle of blood ran from a small immaculata on his forehead.
Run!
Byleth and Mulcibar retreated from the thing, but Horus's legs were rooted to the ground. He didn't know what he was looking at, but some part of his brain recognized the dire threat it represented. The itch on his neck had spread down his back and across his shoulders. A round shape sprouted from the mud monster's chest. The protuberance rotated back and forth as the slime melted away from it. As Horus watched in terror, the bump formed into a second face, smaller and smoother than the one above. Both mouths opened wide. Horus jumped as something grabbed him by the shoulder. It was Mulcibar, trying to pull him along, but Horus still couldn't move. Yet as the thing started walking toward him with ponderous, earth-shaking steps, he realized it was going to destroy him if he didn't run. Mulcibar was hobbling south, away from the river. Horus took off to the east, thinking that splitting up would be the wiser course. He had no idea which way the Queen had gone. Reeds whipped past his face as he followed the river's course. Horus didn't look back, but focused all his attention on running faster. One of his sandals came off in the mud. He left it, sprinting with one sandal until it flew off too. His bare feet dug deep into the wet earth with every step, but he felt faster barefoot. Then he passed through a thicket and plunged up to his shins in water before he could stop himself. The river had turned south in a long loop, cutting off his escape. He looked across its shimmering brown expanse to the far shore, too far away to swim before the monster reached him, and he was too tired to try. Swallowing his fear, Horus turned around. The thing loomed before him, crushing reeds and tearing huge holes in the ground with every step. There was no sign of the Queen or Mulcibar. The monster had followed him. Its fists were larger than his head, and he could only imagine the terrible strength they possessed. He jumped back, deeper into the river. Droplets spattered his face as the massive hand missed him by inches. Cold water swirled around his knees, pulling at him. Horus tried to unleash his magic again, this time squeezing his eyes to tiny slits as he concentrated, but nothing came. Fear constricted him, but there was something else bubbling inside him. Hatred. The rawness of it shocked him, sending him down to a dark place that held no hope. His eyes closed, and everything fell away as a sense of peace settled over him. The water lapped around his thighs, rising higher even though he was standing still. Horus felt a rush of energy surge through him. His eyes shot open as a wall of water washed over him from behind. The wave rushed past him to crash over the earthen creature. Horus remained still as the water pounded the shore with concussive blows that shook the ground. Then the power inside him faded. The water level dropped as the wave retreated past his legs to rejoin the river. He looked around. The riverbank was a swampy morass, the reeds battened down by the powerful flood, but the monster was gone. Where it had lain moments before, there was only a mound of slime that quickly melted away with the receding waters to reveal a pair of human legs sticking out of the mud, and then an arm. The Zawana humming in his chest, Horus approached as quietly as the clinging mud would allow. He made his way around the mud pile to find Gilgan's head. The sorcerer's eyes were closed as if in deep sleep. Trickles of brown water poured from his nostrils. Horus kicked him in the temple, but the wizard did not move. Then Horus staggered back as a wave of vertigo swept over him. His power surged, ready to deal with a new threat. Mulcibar emerged from the reeds. The old nobleman leaned on his cane with every step, both it and the hem of his robe encrusted with mud.
I am glad to see you, Master Horace. I must admit I feared the worst.
I did too.
Mulcibar stood over the corpse.
Remarkable. He was one of my pupils long ago, and he served the Queen for years. This is a black day for the court.
I don't understand what he did.
Mulcibar pointed to the melting ooze around the corpse.
He transformed himself into a Kagaru, a creature of the Kishagal Dominion. It is said that in ancient times they were used as weapons of war, but their construction was banned over 200 years ago by Emperor Otohakin after a series of disastrous wars. Few know the secret to fashioning such a thing today. Honestly, I did not suspect that Gilgon had it in him.
Horace noticed a silver medallion dangling around Mulcibar's neck. Peculiar shapes were etched into its flat, square surface.
What's that?
The nobleman tucked the talisman back inside his robe.
Nothing but an old superstition.
Maybe I should get one, too. I could use a little luck.
Mulcibar knelt beside the corpse and rooted a hand inside Gilgon's clothing.
I would say you have had more than a fair share of good fortune. No other Zoanii alive can boast that they faced a Kogaru and lived to tell of it.
I have no idea how I stopped it.
Water is one of their few weaknesses.
Byleth stepped out of the tall reeds. Even covered in sweat and mud, she looked stunning.
Your Majesty, are you all right?
None the worse, my lord.
The Queen had a long cut down the inside of her left arm, but it appeared shallow.
You were clever to use the river to fight it.
So I've been told, but I had no idea what would happen. I was just trying to get away.
The Queen took Horace by the arm.
Then your streak of good fortune continues.
You may wish to see this, Majesty.
Mulcibar had left Gilgan's robe open. A symbol was branded over the dead wizard's heart of a circle around some wriggly lines. The Queen bent over the body.
The mark of a secret society?
I have only suppositions at this point.
I expect answers, my lord.
Yes, Majesty. I will unravel the truth.
What do we do now?
Now we go home.
Horace squinted against the rising sun as a flying ship descended from the sky. A lean man in a black robe stood at the bow railing. That was all Horace could tell until the vessel landed on the river. A gangplank extended from the deck, and the robed man disembarked.
Lord Astopta!
Byleth went to meet him. Horace found himself pulled along to meet a man who was taller than he had looked from a distance. His complexion was duskier than the typical Akeshian. A long, hawkish nose, bald scalp, and protruding cheekbones lent him a predatory appearance, more suited to a bird of prey than a person. An appearance emphasized by his yellowish-brown eyes. They were like round pebbles, absorbing the daylight and giving nothing back. The Queen squeezed Horace's arm.
Astarta, I want to introduce you to our guest from across the Great Sea. Horace, this is Lord Astarta, my personal counselor.
I've heard the name mentioned, but I don't think we've met.
We should depart with haste. Events conspire at Eregash.
Very well.
Byleth boarded the ship with Lord Astarta. Mulcibar limped over.
Do you remember on the night of the storm when I warned you to be wary?
I remember you advised me to pick a side.
The nobleman nodded toward Lord Astapta's departing figure.
Whichever side you choose, make sure you don't turn your back on that one.
Jaram awoke as someone grasped him by the shoulder. The barracks was still asleep. Only a faint sheen of dawn's light shone through the slatted windows.
Bad dreams?
Emanon knelt beside his bunk. He wore a sleeveless homespun tunic with a sweat stain in the center of the chest.
Where have you been?
I've been busy working on our way out. We need to be included in the next shipment of troops to the front.
I don't know how you'll be able to do that. Unless you convince the commander to send the entire company.
That's beyond my abilities, but what a cooked up should do.
You sure come and go as you please around here. I wish you'd show me that trick.
And spoil the mystery.
When Jaram glared, Emanon held up a hand in surrender.
All right, I have a hidden cache of silver. I use it to bribe the guards and other people I need to do me favors. I also keep my ears open for things I can use against our jailers.
Blackmail and bribery.
They work every time.
It was time for morning roll call. Emanon helped Jaram up from the bed, and they walked out of the barracks house. Jaram took his place in the third rank as dog soldiers fell in around him, rubbing their bleary eyes. Yet he noticed something strange as the company assembled. The two ranks in front of him were empty.
You ready to travel?
Jaram stole a quick glance around. Emanon stood at attention to his left. Chakur, Jerkil, and a few other rebels he recognized stood to his right.
Third rank! Advance two positions!
Jaram stepped forward along with Emanon and the others.
First rank! Report to the quartermaster supply immediately and prepare to move out!
The men of the first row from each company started jogging toward the south end of the camp. Jaram followed beside Emanon.
What just happened? Did you kill the men ahead of us?
No. That would have called too much attention. While we were in Erugash, I got some Yergrub root from my contact. I slipped it into the dinners last night. They'll survive, but they aren't going anywhere for a while.
So what's next?
Telling you would spoil the fun, but be sure to pack an extra pair of boots.
They arrived at the quartermaster behind a crowd of dog soldiers. Officers formed them into a queue, and each man stepped up to receive a large burlap sack. But no weapons, Jaram observed. When it was his turn, he accepted his sack. It weighed over 50 pounds.
What's the load?
The burly man in the leather apron behind the window just glared at him.
Move on!
Jaram found a spot along the wall of the supply building where he could set down his satchel. He untied the hemp cord holding it shut and peered inside. Under several pieces of boiled leather strips with trailing thongs that appeared to be rudimentary armor, he found an iron helmet, a faded purple tunic, several brick-like packages that looked like trail rations, two stoppered bladders, a small digging spade, and a copper hand pick. At the bottom was a pair of hobnailed boots. The graduating dog soldiers were soon herded toward the camp gates high atop the canyon wall. Emanon came over, bringing with him a dozen rebel fighters.
Jaram, you're going to be commanding these men in the field.
I don't need a promotion. Let Jerkil lead them.
He has his own squad. I'm putting them in your hands.
Fine. But I run the squad my way. That means no interference.
Of course, Jaram. They're all yours.
Jaram glared as the rebel captain walked away through the crowd. He didn't want this responsibility, but he had agreed to follow Emanon's orders.
All right. If everyone has their gear, get into formation with the others. We don't want to draw attention to ourselves.
As the squad started to comply, Capicul Hazael rode up on a brown mare. The camp commander wore his usual uniform with a voluminous white cloak that flowed down past his steed's flanks. Several retainers followed him, also on horseback. The bad news was delivered by one of the officers.
This unit will be honored by the presence of the Capicul, who rides with us to glory!
Jaram's hands opened and closed as the commander rode to the forefront of the company. If he'd had a weapon, he might have tried to get close enough to use it. Consequences be damned. Instead, he joined his squad. He didn't know where they were going, but he could bide his time. After Elira learned that Horus had been summoned for a voyage on Her Majesty's flying barge, she had stewed for a little while, imagining all the things a woman of power and hedonistic urges like Byleth could inflict on Horus. Then she had received a note from her palace contact. It said simply, "Lord Astapta has left the palace." Taking the coincidence as divine intervention, Elira had shaken herself out of the pointless worrying and decided to take advantage of having the evening free at the exact time when Lord Astapta was away. This might be her best opportunity to get inside the vizier's chambers. She was successful in surveying the forbidden area, but the horror she saw down below disturbed her beyond belief. Upon making her way out of the tunnels leading to the chamber, Elira stepped into the petitioner's hall on the ground floor of the palace, adjacent to the grand atrium. Because of the lateness of the hour, the hall was empty. She had hidden her cloak in a supply room. Walking as if she belonged here, she crossed the hall toward the slave wing. If she could get back to the suite without being seen or stopped, she might be able to clean up and change her clothes before Horus returned.
Please, Mother of Heaven, let me get back undetected. There is so much I need to tell.
She was composing a message to her superiors in her head when a shadow detached from the darkness of the corridor in front of her. Alira's sandals slid on the smooth marble as she stopped. Then she saw a familiar face.
Safkaet, you nearly frightened me out of my skin.
The slim chambermaid drew near.
Alira, we've been worried about you. Did you do it?
Alira looked about to be sure they were alone. Safkaet was one of her contacts within Aragosh, and a cautious woman by nature, but the Queen's Palace had many ears.
Yes, I was able to get inside. Seph, you would not believe what I saw there. I'm not sure I believe it.
Later, Alira. There is something you must know first. The Queen's flying ship has crashed.
Where? Was anyone hurt?
Little is known except that they were returning when it happened. A ship has been dispatched to find the Queen's party.
How long ago?
About one turn of a glass.
Thank you, Seph. You'd better get back to your wing.
What will you do?
I'll be in Master Horus's chambers. Please get
the
word
women
to me
touched
if you
hands,
hear anything else.
And Alira gave her friend and sometimes lover a quick kiss on the lips. Then Safkaet hurried away down the dimly lit corridor, melding easily into the shadows. Alira went to the stairs and hurried up the cold stone steps. Rimesh stood in the chambers of the High Priest, which were as glorious as any king's bedchamber. Pillars of golden marble supported a coffered ceiling. Huge open windows, trimmed with crimson silk curtains, gave entrance to the dwindling sunlight, which glimmered off the acres of gold leaf that encrusted almost every architectural detail and molding. The only furniture in the front room was a pair of wide chairs against the walls. All in all, despite its opulence, or perhaps because of it, the place felt more like a mausoleum than the private quarters of the temple's leader. Rimesh hesitated, unsure of his next move. He had come to confront a dire threat to the faith, and yet here, on the threshold of another priest's personal space, he wondered if this was a mistake. A slave appeared through one of the far doorways, her slender frame wrapped in a sheer tunic with a short hem that suggested more of her body than Rimesh was comfortable viewing.
I have come to see the High Priest. Summon him at once.
The slave scurried away. A few moments later, High Priest Kadamun entered, wearing a long robe of bright yellow, unbound by a belt. He looked disheveled, as if he had been roused from a deep sleep, and something smudged his eyelids. It appeared to be red pigment, like the makeup worn by some women of the court. Rimesh pressed his lips tight together.
Yes? What is the meaning of this, Menarch? My secretary informed me of no audience this evening.
Rimesh held up a slip of papyrus.
What is the meaning of this?
I am not accustomed to being interrogated in my own chambers like a street criminal. What is that you hold?
This message just arrived from the palace. The Queen's entourage was attacked over the Iron Desert. Her ship crashed with unknown casualties.
That is unfortunate. But there was no need for you to bring the news in person. Any of the temple novices would have...
I am not here to be your damned messenger. I apologize for the outburst, High Priest, but as the representative of the Primarch and the Council of Hierarchs, I am to ask you in person if you had anything to do with this attack on the Queen.
I do not answer to envoys, Menarch. If the Council wishes to question me, they have the right to summon...
We require that the Queen remain alive, at least until she has wed your Nisusi princeling. Her premature demise could destabilize our hold over this city at a time when we need to be most vigilant. The mood in the street is not good. A spark like this might be enough
to... Ah! The streets of Aragosh are never in a good mood. They breed resentment and false piety the way whores breed disease and fatherless whelps. You would do better to focus your attention on uncovering your suspected heretics than worrying about the city's politics.
Really?
Don't glare at me in that manner. You would like Byleth removed from the throne as much as I. You need not deny it. She is a blight on this city, encouraging the people to seek out new ways, mocking the faith. And now she takes a savage to her bed. No, Menarch, do not reproach me. I know not what hand was at work, but while I must denounce the act in public, here in the sanctity of my temple, I will applaud the effort.
Kadamun et Itsur Amur, by the authority of the Primarch, you are hereby stripped of your rank and power.
Save your threats for lesser men. I've been the leader of this temple since before you were inducted to the cloth. Now you will excuse me. I was in the middle of evening devotions when you interrupted.
As the high priest started to turn away, Ramesh gave the signal. The door of the chamber opened and a quartet of order men came to stand beside him.
Leave your belongings. You will go at once to the seclusion cells to dwell upon your actions until I send for you.
Ramesh expected resistance, but Kadamun's shoulders slumped forward and his neck bent down in a long curve. The brothers of the order took the demoted high priest away to his new cell. Ramesh gazed around the chamber with its gaudy decor.
I did not ask for this burden, but I accept it as the price of my duty.
The sun had set over Aragash. Although light from thousands of candles, torches, and lamps flickered across the city, all was quiet. The news had flown from the palace that the queen was missing, and ill rumors lurked in every home and beer hall. Alira sat in the parlor of the suite, watching the door. She hadn't been able to sleep after hearing about the crash, so she had bathed away the grime of the tunnels, put on a new, fresh tunic, and cleaned every room of the suite. After that, there had been nothing left to do but worry. Her heart almost burst from her chest when the front door opened. Alira ran to the foyer and stopped, transfixed, as Horus walked in. His face was scratched, and his fine clothes were covered in mud, but otherwise, he looked fine. She took two long steps and threw her arms around him. Then she released him and backed away.
I heard about the accident. Are you all right? I feared you might be hurt, or...
Not at all. I'm fine, if you can believe it.
Is the queen all right?
Yes. She got a couple of bruises, but nothing serious. The royal physicians are hovering around her now.
Oh, thank the gods.
Lord Mulsabar survived as well, although he's limping worse than before. There was an attack with magic, and everything got very confusing.
Tell me everything while I run your bath.
That sounds wonderful.
Horus brushed a hand down the front of his filthy tunic as she led him into the bathing room.
And we should probably just burn these.
That's what I was thinking, too.
Alira yanked on the bell pull to signal for hot water and then helped Horus out of the clothes. Mud streaked his legs and upper body, but she was relieved not to find any injuries worse than a few bruises.
So what happened? Where did she take you?
Out to the desert. She wanted to show me one of her towns that the Crusaders had taken. We rode in a flying ship. It was amazing. Alira, you wouldn't believe how far you could see from up in the sky.
What of the town?
It was under siege by her army when we got there. Then a storm appeared over the town and things got crazy. But that was nothing compared to the way back. I don't know what happened. One minute we were flying along with no problems, and the next minute... there was an explosion, and the ship dropped out of the sky. People were falling over the side, and the queen was unconscious. I thought we were all gonna die, but then I...
Yes? What did you do? Wait here.
Alira rushed out to the foyer and admitted a procession of slaves carrying buckets of steaming water. They filled the tub while Horus sat on a bench with a towel over his lap. Alira let the slaves out and returned to find Horus already in the water, his head reclined against the side of the tub, eyes closed. She took a soft brush and a flask of bathing oil and knelt behind him. He seemed like he was on the verge of falling asleep.
Now, tell me everything that happened after the explosion.
As Alira listened to Horus's rendition, she was appalled by the brazen nature of the attack. Then Horus described how Gilgan had tried to finish off the survivors with a magical mudman construction and the battle that followed.
Lord Mulsabar called it Krogaru.
Sounds very frightening. Your bathwater is getting cold. I'll call for more.
Alira started to leave, intending to stop by her chamber and add a quick note to her report about what she'd found in Lord Astapta's sanctum. But Horus got out of the tub.
That's all right. I'm about as clean as I'm gonna get.
While Horus wrapped himself in a towel, Alira moved toward the door.
Then let me fetch you a drink.
Wait. I have to tell you something first.
She stopped in the doorway. Horace stepped closer to her. He reached up and touched her collar. It was shockingly intimate, and she felt a desire to pull away, but she stood her ground.
Before the attack, I asked the Queen to free you, and she said yes.
You what?
A slight tingle buzzed around her neck. Then Horace pulled his hand away, and her collar came with it.
You're a free woman, Alira.
Why would you do that? Why?
You're welcome.
Ugh!
Alira spun around and marched out of the chamber and to her bedroom door on stiff legs.
What the hell just happened?
Horace hadn't known exactly what to expect when he told Alira about her freedom. Happiness, certainly. A touch of gratitude, perhaps. But in his wildest dreams, he hadn't anticipated this. He felt like he had insulted her, but had no clues as to how or why. He went to his bedchamber and searched the wardrobe for something light to wear. He just wanted to relax this evening, maybe go to bed early and sleep off the day's events. He pulled out a maroon robe and laid it on the bed. He listened, but it didn't sound like Alira was going to answer it. He threw the robe around his shoulders and went to the foyer. The door opened just before he reached it.
Chancellor?
Unagon entered, bowing his shaven head.
Good evening, Belzama.
Yes. How can I help you?
You have been summoned by Her Majesty, sire.
Now?
The Chancellor beckoned to the hallway and two young servants entered. Horace looked over his shoulder, hoping Alira would appear, but she was evidently too angry at him to investigate.
All right. Wait here.
But the Chancellor and his servants followed Horace to his bedchamber. Within seconds, Horace had been stripped of his comfortable robe and stood naked in the middle of the floor while Unagon flipped through his wardrobe. A tunic of cornflower blue silk with silver embroidery and a matching woolen skirt were selected, along with a clean pair of sandals. Escorted by Chancellor Unagon and a squad of soldiers, Horace was taken to the throne chamber. A crowd of people in exquisite apparel turned to face him. Horace recognized many of the faces from the fete and knew them as members of the noble houses of Aragosh. The Queen's court, all dressed up as for another gala. Horace started toward them. Lord Mulcibar stood at the foot of the throne dais. The Queen's first sword stood opposite the old lord in a suit of plate armor, with three gold knots emblazoned on his shoulder. Horace couldn't recall the man's name. He was a crusty veteran soldier, bald, about 40 years old, with the stern bearing of a career officer. One hand rested on the pommel of the sword at his side. From the doorway, Chancellor Unagon announced him.
Horace Del Rosa, loyal subject of the Empire.
Horace strode ahead. The dais did not remain empty. The door behind the throne opened, and half a dozen young women in silken robes entered to take places along the sides of the dais stairs. Then the Queen came out, wearing a flowing turquoise silk gown that accented her copper skin. Her hair hung straight down her back, adorned only with a golden headband. Gilgun's brother, Jantu, followed the Queen to her throne. Horace tensed at the sight of the sorcerer, envisioning the mud monster standing in his place. He was shocked to see the man still guarding the Queen after what his brother had done, but everyone else seemed at ease. Jantu watched the Queen with his hands folded behind his back, appearing every inch the loyal servant. Horace walked until he reached the bottom step of the dais and stopped. He tried to remain calm while everyone stared at him. Another woman came from behind the throne to stand beside the Queen. Garbed in a bright white robe with silver trim, she was very old. Her silver hair flowed down around her shoulders. To Horace's amazement, Byleth bowed her head and descended a step in deference to this old woman. The woman in white lifted her hands and addressed them.
This night, we gather before the gods of heaven and earth to welcome a new light into the celestial realm. In the name of Lady Sipa, she who lights the darkness, who presents this man?
Mulcibar stepped forward.
I do.
Master Horace, you have been found in possession of the Holy Zoana, which has been passed down to us from the stars. As the first Zoanii did in ancient times, this court welcomes you into their sacred family.
The old woman turned and nodded, and one of the ladies in waiting, or whatever they were, carried a small box to the Queen. Byleth opened it and lifted out a golden medallion on a long chain.
By the authority bestowed upon me as Queen of Erugash, and in the name of the Emperor, may he reign forever unto eternity, I, Byleth et Urdramur, hereby elevate you to the rank of Nejun, with all the customary rights and privileges.
Horus ducked his head to accept the necklace.
In addition, you are named our new commander of the Queen's Guard, Lord Hunzu.
As Horus stepped back with his medallion, the first sword drew his weapon. He held the sword in both hands, as if about to offer the weapon to Horus, but then reversed it and set the point against the seam between his breastplate and scaled skirt. Then Lord Hunzu lunged forward, falling on the hilt, and the blade pierced through his stomach. Horus stumbled backward, his gorge rising. Everyone else in the chamber watched the soldier's suicide without expression. When it was over, and the body lay still on the floor in a widening pool of blood, Byleth climbed back to her throne and sat down.
Lord Horus, our personal safety is now in your capable hands. Please come to our chambers at the 7th hour to discuss your new responsibilities.
Mulcibar bowed, and Horus did likewise. He and the nobleman backed away from the dais together, bowing every 10th step. Then they were outside the hall, and the doors closed in front of them. Horus glimpsed the queen walking behind the throne with Jantu and her ladies in tow, while the old woman in white stood over Lord Hunzu's corpse.
What the hell?
Mulcibar held up a hand and glanced at the guards positioned outside the doors. With a curled finger, he beckoned Horus to follow him down the wide hallway. After the ceremony, Lord Mulcibar took Horus to an outdoor eatery, where they sat on a rooftop overlooking the city and drank fiery concoctions under the stars. Mulcibar gave several congratulatory toasts, but otherwise they spoke little. While he nursed his 6th cup of spirits laced with lime juice, Horus played back the crash in his mind. Something had been bothering him.
Why would Gilgan betray the queen? I don't understand what could possess someone like him who had everything to do that.
We rarely know what people are thinking in the privacy of their own thoughts. Some Zoanii use mental sifting on their servants and vassals, but Her Majesty has seldom done so. Perhaps that will change now, though I hope not. The Queen enjoys the support of her people more than any king I've ever seen, because while she is a stern mistress, she is not cruel.
Why did the power react like that at the riverbank? I wasn't trying to summon the water. I don't know what I was trying to do, but hitting that thing with a big wave was the furthest thing from my mind.
The Zoana is more than a source of power. It guides us through our intentions.
It controls us?
Not exactly. Many Zoanii spend their entire lives trying to understand the power. There are tomes in the royal archives you should study, going back centuries.
This sounds strange, but it felt like the river came alive somehow, like it was fighting for me, or through me.
That is curious, but not altogether implausible. The Typhon River is Acacia. Even our name, the Land of the Black Earth, comes from its rich soils that sustain us. But the river is more than that. It is the embodiment of our entire culture. The old stories say that during the Annunciation, when the gods came down to Earth to see what they had wrought, Temu, Queen of the Waters, claimed Acacia for herself. She created the Typhon to protect this land and its people. In fact, the first people to settle here were called the Temerites. They were conquered by a tribe called the Chaldeans more than 1,000 years ago and vanished from the earth. And then my ancestors, the Acacii, conquered the Chaldeans around 6 centuries ago.
And you consider my people warlike? Sure, we knock each other around sometime, but we don't slaughter entire nations.
We have a violent history, and some of that continues to this day. But you can still see signs of the Chaldeans among us. We borrowed their architecture and their letters. We even adopted their gods. one other bit of information that might interest you. Prince Zazil has gone missing.
Is the Queen all right? She must be worried out of her mind.
She appears to have taken it in stride.
By the time he arrived back to his rooms, Horace was so tired and inebriated he could barely walk. He flopped down onto one of the divans in the sitting chamber and leaned back against the sumptuous cushions. Beams of moonlight slanted through the room's darkness and formed pools of silver on the floor.
Horace?
Alira stood at the door to her room. Her hair was mussed, as if she'd been tossing and turning in her sleep.
First Sword Horace, present.
Are you?
Alira came closer. When the moonlight caught her, Horace froze. She was beautiful, perhaps the most beautiful woman he'd ever seen, since his wife.
What?
I'm sorry about before.
It's all right.
No, you were being kind. Kinder than I had any right to expect. I was caught by surprise and reacted badly. Please forgive me.
Sure. Come sit with me.
Alira came over to the divan and sat next to Horace.
They made the old guard commander kill himself. Did you know that? He just put the sword against his belly and...
Horace rammed both hands against his stomach.
Done.
I know. It's their custom. When a soldier fails, there's only one way he can make amends.
It's insane.
Because you're not a Kishian. If the queen hadn't asked for his life, the shame would have been greater. This way, his family can keep their honor.
Honor and shame. What good are they if you're dead?
Don't you believe in a life after this one?
Sure, but we're talking about the here and now.
You have to learn how the Akishians think. For them, the next life isn't an abstract idea. It's the cornerstone of their entire lives, from birth to death.
That's...
crazy? Not to them. You're an important man now, Horace. You have rank and authority, not to mention your magic.
Yes, let's not mention that.
Horace, you won't be able to hide anymore.
Is that what I've been doing all this time? I was taken captive, beaten, marched across a desert, and attacked at every turn.
Yes, those things were horrible, but they are nothing compared to what you face now. You are a foreigner, and yet you possess the Zoana, which is as close to divinity for the Akeshians as the prophet is to you. And being Zoaniai is about more than religion. It's also political, and the Akeshians play politics like other people wage war. They will not sit idle while you get your bearings. They'll come for you.
Then what should I do?
Stay one step ahead of them, and don't be afraid to meet their hostility with force. Trying to negotiate will only make you look weak in their eyes. And stay near the queen. She seeks to use you, obviously.
Obviously.
But that doesn't mean you cannot use her, too. Aragosh is one of the most powerful cities in the Empire. As the queen's fortunes rise, so too can yours. What?
I was just going to ask what I've done to deserve such compassion. You're a slave and...
Not any longer.
I should have asked you before I approached the queen about that.
No, it was a noble gesture. I'm sure the queen was surprised.
She was uncertain of the results.
Did Her Majesty suggest that I would be more attentive after I was freed, or less?
She wasn't specific.
Well, I hope you didn't think that taking off my collar would oblige me to do anything special for you, or to you.
No, not at all. It just seemed like the right thing to do.
Good, because I'd hate for you to misinterpret this.
Alira leaned forward and put her mouth to his. Despite his inebriated condition and the conflicting thoughts in his head, Horace found himself responding to her. Eventually, she pulled back.
That was unexpected.
Good.
Alira got up and walked back to her room. Horace didn't know whether or not she wanted him to follow. Not until she closed the door behind her. He tottered to his own room and closed the door behind him. He collapsed on the bed.
God in heaven, you certainly made women detest us, didn't you?